Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you this blustery, cold, but sunshiny winter's day?
I am warm and dry and safe, so I am happy.
You're ahead of a lot of other people.
Yep, I am. Content where I'm at, so I'm good.
Right. Please consider clicking the like or subscribe button that's down below. And you also find in the description of this video everything related to the Paranormalist podcast, the Facebook groups, email address, and all of the associated other things with it, including Patty's books on Amazon. So thank you. And here we go with the episode. Mm-hmm. All right. So what do you have for us today?
So what I wanted to talk about today was South American witches. They're known, there's lots of different terms for them, but the main term I kept coming across was bruja or brujo. It's Spanish, so it's gender specific, the A being feminine and the O being male. Interestingly enough, most of the stories are about male witches, not female witches. Mm-hmm. And they're very different in a lot of respects from like the Celtic witches and the European witches that kind of migrated over story-wise and what have you with our founding fathers and what. So it's really a completely different thing. You see a lot of elements of Catholicism because of the Spanish influence. You see a lot of Native American influences because obviously their cultures, you know, their Incan cultures or different cultures that they had are married together with that Spanish / Catholic thing. It's a lot like voodoo and what have you in those respects. But it was fascinating. And I came across a witch trial from the 1880s, which is an insane story. And I can't wait to share this with everybody. And so I wanted to start with that particular story. So in Chile, there is a story called Cleo's Murderous Society of Warlocks. It sounds insane. This is a group, however, of warlocks that date back to the late 1600s. So it's a fascinating story. And this is the story that ends in a trial of the warlocks for witchcraft in the 1880s. So let's sort of get involved in all of this. So there is a place called the Mall River. It kind of empties into the Pacific Ocean. And in the 16th century, it was the spot where the Empire of the Incas ended. And there's a lot of mystery and what have you that surrounds the end of the Incas, this particular region. And the Incas actually thought that this area was filled with mystery and darkness. It was known variously by the Incas as the place of the seagulls. And it was also known as a very, very dark place filled with witchcraft. And that is the area where this all transpires. So when the first Europeans came over in 1567, Cleo had already been known for being a place for privateers. Privateers were pirates who were hired by the British, the Spanish, or the French governments to attack the ships of their enemies. So you were literally a pirate, but you had kind of a clear passage and some credentials from whatever country hired you, kind of like a mercenary. And then, of course, piracy. So there was a huge amount of piracy, privateering, and tons of upheaval, revolt. The Spanish had tried to quell this entire region and take it over, but the people in the Cleo area had resisted immensely, and they retained a huge amount of independence. And they also had what appears to almost be like a shadow government. So for this, there was a British traveler by the name of Bruce Chatwin, who wrote about these sorcerers. There's a cave in this area that supposedly houses, has housed since the late 1500s at the very least, these witches, these warlocks. And Bruce Chatwin actually comes from the 1970s, and he did a lot of research based on writings all the way back into history, from religious leaders, from travelers, from pirates, different people who encountered them in some form or fashion. It is insane. So this there was a sect of these male witches. They lived for the purpose, and this is exactly how he writes it, for the purpose of hurting people. They basically were somewhere between what we would consider a coven and a mafia. So the people in that area were told, if you don't pay us protection money, we'll put spells on your family and kill your children. People would from time to time challenge them and say, you know, I'm not paying you. That's ridiculous. You're just a bully. And then they would die from mysterious poisonings. And then their families would die from mysterious poisonings, and which all could be completely legitimately just nasty people. But at one point, over 100 of these warlocks were gathered together and arrested in a trial. A huge trial happens, and this is where a lot of the testimony of what really went on comes from, because they testified in court. So at the time of the prior to the arrest, and at the time of the arrest, there was a farmer by the name of Matteo Pontacar, who was 70 years old. He admitted that he was the leader of this organization that called itself the Righteous Provenance. So even though they were called something else by the rest of the people, that's what they themselves called each other. Mm-hmm. And during the testimony, he would talk about the fact that they had a hierarchy of kings and viceroys, that they were important to the power structure, and that they were warlocks of the first degree. He talked about this cave, this huge cave that existed near the Chillicothe, these little towns in the Chillicothe area, and that the cave, according to their testimony, the caves were lit by torches burning human fat. There were a pair of monsters that guarded the society's secret treasured possessions inside the cave. Those possessions were a leather book of magic and a bowl that, when filled with water, allowed secrets to be seen. So scrying would be what it was before. And the book, it sounds very much like a regular, you know, like a book of magic that you would get from Europe. But this book, I don't know that, they don't tell you where it came from. Possibly from Spanish tradition, possibly from some piracy, that, you know, somebody that came here as a pirate or a privateer or something, but it was definitely there. Now, there was a gentleman who in the 1881, when this whole thing starts, his name was Benjamin McKenna. He was a historian, and he gathered together all the documents and testimony of the trial. And I really thought this was the most fascinating story. So the island's a little island. It's about the size of Puerto Rico. It's a very rural land, and there was a leader prior to this farmer whose name was Jose Merriman, and he was the king of the warlocks. And during this time period, he ordered the locals to go into the cave with meat for the animals that lived inside. And these he decreed were to be fed the meat of a kid, so a lamb. I'm hoping that's what that meant, because in some of the other documents, it isn't. But I'm hoping that it was that, I'm praying, that was slaughtered anyhow. And that Merriman went with this these other leaders into this cave with the man who had the meat for these animals, and they're not animals. They're not exactly animals at all. As soon as he entered the cave, according to the testimony, he began to dance around and quickly opened a doorway. I'm going to read this part because I can't do better than describe it the way they described it. So he's dancing and he's calling out these words and undulating, and then this entryway opens at the mouth of the cave, which was hidden by dirt and grass and what have you. It is covered with a layer of earth and grass, and under there was a piece of metal that they called the alchemy key. He used it to open the entryway, and then those who were with him faced two disfigured beings which burst out of the darkness and rushed at them. One looked like a goat on all dragging along on four legs, and the other was a naked man with a white beard and hair down to his waist. Now, these creatures were encountered multiple times by multiple people over the course of time, and there is a these are the guardians of the cave. So whenever one of them would die or what have you, they would create a new guardian. And they were called the Invuluk, which is a deformed human being with its head twisted backward, along with having twisted arms, fingers, nose, mouth, and ears. The creature walks on 1 foot or on 3 feet, actually 1 foot and two hands is how it's described.
Weird. Yeah.
And because of its leg and its deformity, its skin is blue, its teeth are sharpened, it cannot talk, but it growls and has a guttural sound that is most unpleasant. It is trained. The legend says that the Imbunic is a firstborn child less than 9 days old, kidnapped and sold by the parents to the Brujo, and that the baby cannot be christened, that this child is then broken and deformed over the course of time. Like they break its legs and they break his, like they just, to deform him deliberately. And they used some sort of a cream that would make his skin go blue. And that might sound completely incredible, but there is a, I'm trying to think what it's called. It's a kind of a silver that they use for medical purposes. And if you get too much of it, it'll cause your skin to turn permanently blue.
I was thinking cobalt, but that, yeah. I mean, that would be more radioactive.
And it's fed on cat milk, which I don't even want to think how you would milk a cat.
A really small stool in a bucket.
I know. It sounds insane. And goat meat and human corpses from cemeteries. And I mean, it's just an insane story. And then it only leaves the cave if the cave is destroyed or if it's been discovered and the warlocks move him to another cave. And as one dies, another is procured and trained to follow the same. And the other is this this beast that was once human as well and was also destroyed and damaged. And so these two beings are considered supernaturally enchanted by the warlocks, and their job, their sole existence is to protect the cave and the book and the screening bowl from others finding it. It sounds crazy, but among the things that were testified to during this trial is the fact that the members of the Righteous Providence claimed to possess the ability to fly using a special word, a rilfu, which they would scream as they leapt into the air. They would wear a magic waistcoat known as the Muchen that gave them the power to defy gravity. It was made out of the skin of a human. They were also given, each warlock was given a small live lizard that was strapped to his head with a bandana type thing. And this with magical creature would then give all sorts of forbidden knowledge to the person, and it would teach the human initiate how to transform into a animal and how to open locked doors. They also talked about they would use seahorses to convey them in a magical vessel, and that this vessel actually is the Calatoon, which is supposedly a ship that gathers the dead of sailors. And today it's usually told as a ghost story, and has kind of broken away from the main legend. But it's just this amazing story. And these witches would need spies. Now, this is fascinating. You're going to hear more about these creatures, so bear with me. So they would take young girls from the local villages who were about 9 to 12 years old. They would strip them naked and give them this drink made out of wolf oil and herbs. And the potion was so disgusting, it would cause them, this is what the story says, it would cause them to vomit up their intestines. The girls would turn into large, long-legged birds resembling rooks, and they would complete their mission and then return by daybreak and reabsorb their intestines and go home. But they were under the spell and the power of these beings. Now, I want you to think about it. When you look at the Southwestern lore, you're going to come across these bird people over and over again in so many different ways. You're going to come across these beings that can shape shift and morph into, you know, skinwalkers and what have you, all these different creatures. And very much like the skinwalker story, in order to complete this process, you must murder a family member to become a complete warlock. You have to show that you have laid aside all human commitments. So even though this was built in an isolated area at an isolated time, it literally carries the same themes as the Southwestern American Native American and Native American witchcraft and legends and lore, using a lot of the same themes with a lot of the same outcomes. And it's just really interesting that it would independently develop in this other place in time. And we're talking the 1500s, 1600s here. This is not a time when there should have been a lot of intermingling. It's not like you could get on the internet and go, oh yeah, I read about them skinwalker things. It's just a really fascinating thing. And here's the thing that makes this even worse, is that in 1880, whenever this whole trial began, some of the older warlocks testified that they were very angry and upset about the way the warlocks' society had changed, that it wasn't about pure magic anymore, that it was about vendettas and vindictiveness and finances. And they felt that this magic had been corrupted in some way. Now, to make sure everybody understands, Brujos are not necessarily bad people. There's white and there's dark magic. And this group that I'm talking about now were literally consecrated for dark magic. And they were the most powerful sect in Chile at that time. And everybody in the region knew who they were. They knew what they were about. There were good witches, and we'll come across them here shortly. And they attempted to mitigate what was going on. But it's just the most insane of stories. And as I was reading through this, and I was listening about the shamans and the healers and the brujo and the bruja and the good and the bad, I'm thinking this is played out in our own history in the American Southwest. The shape-shifting beings, the requirement to, you know, give up your humanity and consume human flesh to kill other humans. All these, they don't happen necessarily in all the other cultures. Some do. But there's a theme that's running through this that I found really interesting.
One of the more bizarre things that you've told, at any rate.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, it is a theme that runs over and over and over again through around the world. If you would go to Africa or you would go to the Arab countries, you will find dark witches who do the same things. That whatever this arcane knowledge is, it's arcane knowledge. It's not just the local superstition. It has spread around the world. So among all the crazy and all the hype and all the other stuff, there is an element of truth to this, or at least an element of belief that this is true. And to this day, it should be noted that there is the belief that this cave exists, that this entire thing is continuing, that despite the 100 people that were arrested and the trials and the government trying to get a hold of all of this because they wanted to break the back of the Brujo in the area. And again, that also came with that independence from the Spanish government and all of that. They wanted to get past all of that. And despite all of that, it just continues to this day. And it's like a never-ending theme. And it's not just in Chile. When you go to Mexico, there's a huge amount of both good and bad, white and black magic that happens. And again, it's pre-Hispanic and Hispanic beliefs, Catholic beliefs. It's all merged together. And very much like you see in the Caribbean with the voodoo and what have you. And they married it together and created this own, their own kind of religion. And it's really dark in spots and it never stops. So I was reading about in Mexico, there are what are called bruja markets or witch markets, where they sell all kinds of like talismans and what have you. But if you go and you go into these places, you can find out about brujos, good and bad. And they're still functioning all over the American Southwest, all over Mexico, all over the South America. And so I wanted to tell a couple, some of these stories, because they are just insane in so many respects. So the first one we're going to talk about is about this two Americans who went to South America, to Mexico. They were looking for brujas to write an article about. And over the course of the first couple days, they had a waitress at one of the places they had eaten. They were asking people about, you know, do you know where there's any brujas, any real ones, and yada yada. And then waitress said, I know exactly who to send you to. And she sends them to a guy by the name of Enrique Martin, who is a head sorcerer or a brujomar, which is like a mayor, like a town mayor. And but he means, I mean, this in this culture, it means the head sorcerer for the region. So they actually go to this place. They tell this amazing story of how they go there. They meet this person, and there's this huge line of people who have come to get curses broken and physical health issues addressed. And he comes up to them and he says, I want you to go to this little hut behind my home, and I want you to sit in that hut, and I want you to think about for 15 minutes the best things that ever happened to you, and then the worst things that have ever happened to you. And there'll be candles lit all around you. And I want you to push, as soon as you see or you think of a bad thing, I want you to push it into the candlelight, like mentally push it into the candlelight. I will be back there in a little while and I will work with you. You need a cleansing. So they go back and they do exactly that. And they said, you know, it wasn't anything like what they expected. There wasn't a lot of opulence. There was no guy with a cane and a cape and the whole nine yards. This was just a guy dressed in some light white clothes, and he had, you know, he's in his 40s, and he, you know, got them settled, and they said that the only thing that they noticed that was a little macabre were, like, there were some bones on a necklace around his neck, animal bones, they were hoping. And so they go and they follow the ritual for the cleansing. They go into this little hut, and there are all these candles lit around it, and it's kind of reddish because the candles are in reddish containers. And it almost like a hellscape is how the guy describes it. Like, he's inside there and it's hot and it smells and it's close. And they're sitting there trying to envision their worst moments, the most traumatic moments. And he said, all of a sudden I felt my eyes waver between the brightness, and I was on the brink of tears, and I was asked to relive the most significant moments of my life. And I was caught up in it. Then the man comes in, Martin, and he begins to talk to them and ask them questions. And as this, he's doing this, he's laying a fire around the inside of this hut. And as they're talking, the fire is like burning towards them into the center. And the more they talk, like, the more the fire comes close and closer. And he keeps telling them, don't pay any attention. Every part of this building is filled with pentagrams. The windows are cut into little pentagram shapes. Everything's all covered in pentagrams. And Martin keeps saying to them, don't pay attention to the fire. Don't worry about the fire. At one point, they literally are pinned in the center of this fire. They can feel it licking at their skin. They're literally inches from the fire. And they want to go. And Martin won't let them, and he won't let them out. And he continues to do whatever magic he's doing. And then all of a sudden, the flames go out. She's gone. At which point, the gentleman who's writing the article says, suddenly we were in a kind of walking stupor. We were going back toward Martin's house, and he gave us a little tour. He said, I'm not a sorcerer. I'm a spiritual guide. And he took him into what he called the spiritual house, which was a place, again, filled with red votive candles. And there was a statue of a devil on a table with a pile of folded notes. And there were notes hung on clothespins above the devil. And they were wax dolls with pins sticking through them, hanging above the devil. And actually, there's a photograph that actually accompanies the article. It's very, there's everything's covered in pentagrams. There's a big pentagram behind him. There's pentagrams on the tables. There's pentagrams everywhere you look. And then it's over. And he says how exhausted they both were, how they didn't eat or drink anything. They were deliberately cautious of that because they didn't want to be poisoned or, you know, drugged in some way. So they can't explain it, but they just went to the hotel where they were staying, and they were so exhausted. And he said after this was over with, he felt completely different. Like, he felt as though something had been taken out of him. He doesn't say if that's a good or a bad thing. He just says he definitely felt different. And when he went in as a skeptic. When he left, not so much. And it reminded me so much of The Serpent and the Rainbow, where the scientists went down to try to find out what, you know, caused the zombies. And he was looking for science, but what he ended up with was finding that there was a huge spiritual element as well. And that's basically what happened to these people, not quite as dramatic. And he said, for the next 2 days, we began to wonder, where does religion end and magic begin? As we went through, we went to many, they went to other Brujos, and he said that he interviewed a ton of people. There's these little gnomes that are in that area, that he talked to women who said these gnomes come and they'll attack their children, their babies. And again, that sounds very much like in Europe, where they talked about the changelings and children being taken and by the gnomes. And he said that there were hauntings, and that These beings would steal unbaptized babies, and that's one of the reasons it was so important to get your baby baptized right away to protect them from being changelings is pretty much where that goes to. And then he said, I talked to a woman who was not religious, and she said she never thought she would consider the supernatural, but she had this experience. She was an American who moved to Mexico for work, and she said in the house she was living in, she was told that it was haunted, and she poo-pooed it, and she was like, okay, this is a cute little story, but, like, dude, I come from, like, the New York City. I'm not interested in your bull crap. So she said, but her daughter, who was a little, she had a little daughter who she was raising, she said, the toys in my daughter's room would light up and sing on their own at night, even after I took their batteries out of them. And I have to tell you, I've actually seen that happen someplace once where I actually took the battery. They cut the battery pack out of the toy and it continued to talk. So I don't doubt that it's a possibility. And then she said about things were moved from places where she had left them, that she went to a neighbor who said to her, you are not going to get relief until you have your child baptized. You should do it before something happens to her. And she didn't believe her at the beginning. And she said, but I went and got my daughter baptized the next day because I was terrified. Things were escalating. My daughter was found outside and we don't know how she got there the night before I went for the baptism. And then she talks about how she asked the priest to come and cleanse the building. And ever since then, nothing has happened. The doors stay nice and locked. Her daughter stays in her bed at night. And the toys no longer sing and talk on their own. And she's like, I didn't believe this was true, but here I am. I still don't believe in magic. I don't know what is going on. I only know that what happened to me was real. And you hear that a lot, you know, with skeptics. I don't believe in it, but let me tell you my ghost story. So this was a fascinating tour that they took, and they talk about, you know, all the different things. One of them talked about seeing a vision of a young child covered in darkness. And when they went outside to look for this child, like, the child was there looking in the window at them, and then all of a sudden just this massive darkness enveloped the child. It frightened them, and they went running outside to see what was going on, and there was no child. But they clearly saw the child, and the door was only 10 steps away. And they said, like, we couldn't explain the stuff that was going on. And yet there it was. Now, as I said, this is happening all over the country. It's actually all over the world, but in the United States, we have a ton of these stories and we don't recognize them as what they are. So I wanted to share some. So this one comes from San Antonio, Texas. And La Chuzra is a owl witch, a witch that manifests as a human-sized owl, if you will. Huh. And that's how it comes. And I've heard stories of La Chuzra before, so it's not a shock to me that they exist. This is a story told from his mother. He said, my mother told me a story when I was young about her life in the 1960s. Beside her was her home was a home of a woman who was a bruja. And she was a mean bruja. She bullied my grandmother constantly. She threatened my grandmother and made her afraid and didn't like my grandmother. She would leave candles lit on my grandmother's porch with these strange writings all over the porch. And she would stand in front of the house casting spells and chanting. And my grandmother and my mom would leave the house in fear. And one day, his Uncle Tommy, who had been, was about 19, 20 years old and had been in the Vietnam War. He came home to stay with the family on a leave. And he woke up and he found the candles on the porch, the writing, the whole nine yards, all that stuff going on. And he was really angry about it. And that's whenever they heard this loud whistling sound. And he says, my Uncle Tommy went out and They wanted to see what was going on. He was sure it was just the old lady and that she was playing tricks to scare my grandmother so my grandmother would move. But when he got to the porch, he saw a large bird with an ugly face that was almost human, like an old lady's face. And he said it flew around the outside of my grandmother's house, whistling. My grandmother was frightened. And she said it was Lachuzra, the witch owl. It had come to curse them. She dropped to her knees and began to pray the rosary. She told everyone they had to pray the rosary, or Lachuzra would kill them. And he says that that Tommy went out and was yelling at this Lachuzra and at the witch lady's house and telling them, you know, I'm not afraid of you. You know, you don't scare me. I don't know what kind of crazy magic this is, but I'm not afraid. You know, he had a different perspective. He had been in a war. So to him, this was not the most terrifying thing he had ever seen, I'm sure. And he said about 6 months after my uncle left, he went to California, and there he died in a car accident. My grandmother always believed that it was because he had cursed out the Lachuzra and the Bruja, and that he had gotten himself cursed by the Bruja. And he's saying, you know, I honestly believe that they might be right. My mother swears to this day that is what killed her brother, not a car accident. And then it's an interesting story. And then he tells another story. He says that only weeks before his Uncle Tommy died, there was a knock on the door of the house where his mother and grandmother lived, and there was this being standing there. It was looked like a skeleton and was so thin and pale, and my grandmother was afraid of it, but she had a large heart, and she said to it, I will feed you. And the thing said, I want to come inside. And again,
never a good idea.
Seeking permission. And the grandmother said, I will help you outside. And the being stomped in and told the grandmother that she had angered a powerful bourgeois, and that a curse had been put upon her, that the witch began to vomit up human hair, and as it was choking and gagging this hair, grandmother almost passed out, and his mother ran and got an ambulance. The ambulance came and the paramedics arrived, and they took this old woman to the hospital, where she died later that day. But the paramedics did not know what to do with her, and they saw the woman vomiting the hair as well. And it was after that that Tommy died. I mean, they're just a totally different type of terrifying haunting. So there is, as I said, there's the bourgeois, and then there's these others. There's called curanderas, which are usually herb witches. Like, we would call them wise women, women who were able to do healings, you know, using certain herbs and what have you. And people would come. This is a young man telling a story about how his grandmother was one of the curandera, and she would, every weekend, she would, you know, have these lines of people that would walk hours to come to her to get help. And she would spend all day on Saturday and Sunday trying for them, to help them. And he said about one time when he was a kid, he saw this young man come who was very tall and frail. He was very thin and gaunt. And he came to the curandera, and told her that he had fallen in love with a young girl. And he had wanted to marry her. But because he was poor, her family said no, that she could do better, basically. And he said, I had heard that they were from a bad family. So I left her alone, and I told her it was for the best that, you know, we not be together, because there would never be peace. It would be a lot of dissension between us. And he said, after that, the girl's family moved away. And he said, but I was told that her mother cursed the ground I walked on and that she would find a way to hurt me. And it turned out that the young lady was pregnant, but she had not told him. And that's why the family moved away. And when the young man heard this, he began trying to find the girl to make it right. And that's when he grew very sick. And then he talks about how his grandmother made this elixir and gave it to the woman, the young man and his mother who had come, and that they came back the following week, and again the following week after that, and that the young man was beginning to look better, to physically feel better, to eat, because he had not been able to hold food in his stomach for weeks prior to visiting his grandmother. And at that point, the woman and the boy came back again a fourth time. And when they came back this time, they said that they had seen the Lachuzra, which is the owl witch, and it had been circling outside their window the night before, and that they were terrified. And the grandmother tells this young man that that was the girl. The girl was a Lachuzra. She was the witch. She was the one who did the cursing. She is the one who brought all of this upon him because he refused her. And then she gave him another potion and she said, go home and do not think of this girl. Do not call this girl to you in any way. And he did, and he grew well. But had he continued to pine for her, to think of her, to wonder what happened, that the Lachuzra, the witch, the owl witch that she had become, would continue to take his strength until it had killed him. And I know, like I said, I most people have never heard of the Lachuzra, but it is a it's a very common theme in Southwestern lore and Hispanic lore. This owl witch, the size of a human being. There's a story, another story that I had come across about a young woman whose father remarried, and the woman he married was a Bruja, and she didn't like the young girl, and so she began making life miserable for the kid. The kid was about 14 years old, and she said we would hear horrible noises and terrible things would happen, and you would hear knocking on the doors, and the bourgeois would say, that is coming for you. I've called it for you, child. Well, over the course of time, the girl finally left and she went to live with her grandmother, and that's when things kind of came to a head. So now she's like in her 16, 17 years old, living with her grandmother. Her father doesn't believe her, and that her mother is a bourgeois, her stepmother is a bourgeois. And that's whenever this event, series of events happened. So one night she's sleeping at her grandmother's house, and all of a sudden she said there were these loud knocks on the front door. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and everybody woke up and came tumbling downstairs. Again, they heard the knocks at the door, and she said, my grandmother went towards the door and said, who is it? No one answered, but the knocking came louder than before. She said, we were all getting angry. And in Spanish, I knew it was my stepmother, and I yelled and I told her to go away. And that's whenever the whistles and the shrieks began to get louder, and they moved from all around the outside as though there were 100 of them outside the doors, just moving roll in a ring around the house. And she said that at that point we heard evil cackling laughter as if someone was laughing at you. So then we began to pray, all of us. We could hear this thing flapping against the doors, flapping against the windows. And when we looked, the window in the one room had no curtain, and we could see it peering in at us before it flew onto the next window, as though it were looking. It was a huge bird-like creature, the size of a human. It was covered in brown fur, and it was female. We could tell because it had breasts. It was eating something that was in its hands, and yet its wings flapped, We could see it from the kitchen windows, and the lights were off. My grandmother told me not to talk because it would hear us. I did not believe her. I was scared, so I kept my mouth shut. And I remembered my dad's wife's threat that she would come and get me because I had spilled the beans that she was a bourgeois. I went back to my room with my grandmother, and in the morning, I knew that this thing was gone, that we had withheld it. But laying on our front porch were three dead cats. Their eyes were missing. And we saw blood spots all over our porch. It was the bourgeois letting me know that she was continuing to curse me. She intimidated me, but I have refused to allow for it. And I have found bourgeois who are good, who have broken the spell. And I am told that that is what has killed her. My stepmother died blind, as though in retribution for poking the eyes out of those cats.
It just boggles my mind that things like this can still exist in today's day and age, unrevealed en masse. You know, like, everybody's got a camera, you know, everybody's got a portable TV studio they carry in their hand. You know, that's
no, I mean, but I think the thing about them is that, and I've seen really odd photos of what look like huge owl beings and stuff like this, but I don't know that we'll ever fully be able to prove anything like this because it's spiritual in nature. And you know, I've told the story about my grandmother and the old lady that from down the street that put a curse on my aunt and all this, and people poo-pooed it. And I guess possibly that's one of the reasons I believe that, you know, this could very well be, because this has traveled through time so long, so many cultures, so many different areas, and it never changes. The monster doesn't change. It's never a cat. It's always the owl being. It's, you know, the stories are never, they're never different, and they've lasted for generations and generations, and all of that I find really fascinating. And they're all the way till today. I mean, like, I've got stories that go all the way from the 1500s all the way up to literally this past year. And it's stories about people getting ill, crossing the wrong person, having to seek assistance from healers and bourgeois and what have you. It's just, it's a part of these cultures. And if it was just cultural, then it would not travel so. But it's traveled. It's traveling all over. It's always traveling. It travels from Italian communities in Italy all the way to the United States. It's traveled through Spanish communities to the United States. It's traveled all around the world. And every culture has their version thereof. And I just, you know, if anybody has any stories, if they've ever encountered anything like the Lechuzera, let us know. There are tons and tons of these stories all around the world, literally. And bourgeois are like powwowers. There's good powwowers and there's bad powwowers. And in the Amish in Pennsylvania German community, there are so many parallels that you see going down through these that it's just insane. And I just wanted to share a little bit of this and talk a little bit about it because, you know, it's not going away. They're happening to this very day. So with that, I'm going to end this. If anybody has any questions, want to share a story, we would love to hear them. There's just a ton of this that is out there. And even though it is the modern world, as you know, the cultures and everything has changed, there's an undercurrent that never leaves. It has never left in thousands of years. I don't know that it ever will.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Here's where I say good night and you say good night.
Okay. So good night, Stu.